Welcome back, Deep Divers. Ready for another deep dive?
Always.
Today we're going to be tackling some pretty complex stuff.
Yeah.
Structuralism and rhetorical criticism.
Nice.
Our source material for this one is some pretty dense academic lecture notes.
Oh, wow.
Focusing on biblical hermeneutics.
Okay.
Don't worry, though.
Yeah.
I promise it's going to be a fascinating deep dive.
I'm sure.
Basically, we're going to try to learn how to read between the lines and understand the hidden persuasive power of texts.
Sounds good.
So let's start with structuralism.
Okay.
I've heard it described as like a way of finding the deep structure of a text,
mm-hmm.
kind of like uncovering a blueprint beneath the surface.
Right.
But what does that actually like mean?
Well, think of it like an iceberg.
Okay.
What we see on the surface,
yeah.
the words, the sentences, the plot, that's just the tip.
Right.
Structuralism dives beneath the surface to explore the underlying patterns, relationships, and structures that give the text its meaning.
So it's not just about what the author's saying, but like how they're saying it.
Yeah. And even the deeper structures that might be influencing them without them realizing it.
Whoa, that's trippy.
I know, right?
So how do we... How do we actually get at those hidden structures?
Well, one tool structuralists use is the ectantial model.
Ectantial model.
Yeah, it's especially useful for understanding narratives.
Okay.
It breaks down a story into key roles.
Like what?
Like the sender, the object, the receiver, the subject, the helpers, and the opponents.
So instead of just reading a story for the plot, we're like looking at the underlying forces that drive it.
Exactly.
So how would that work with like a biblical text?
Well, take the book of Revelation. It's full of strange imagery and symbolism, right?
Definitely.
But the ectantial model can help us make sense of it.
How so?
Well, you could see God as the sender.
Okay.
Who wants to communicate a message of salvation and judgment, which would be the object to the church or even the whole world, the receiver.
I see.
Jesus Christ becomes the subject.
Okay.
Aided by angels, the helpers,
mm-hmm.
and opposed by Satan, the opponent.
Wow. That actually makes Revelation sound a bit less confusing.
Right.
So by identifying these roles, we can understand the power dynamics and the message being conveyed.
Exactly. It helps us see the bigger picture, the underlying structure that shapes the narrative.
This is all very cool.
Yeah.
But wasn't structuralism more of a trend in the past?
Mm.
It seems like I don't hear as much about it these days.
You're right.
What happened?
It's true that structuralism's popularity has waned a bit.
Why is that?
Well, for one, it can be quite complex and use a lot of specialized vocabulary.
So it's hard to understand.
Yeah, even for academics, it can be a challenge to grasp.
Right.
There's also the issue of validating interpretations.
Mm-hmm.
It can feel a bit subjective at times.
I can see that.
Like, how do we know we've uncovered the true deep structure and not just imposed our own ideas onto the text?
Right.
And then there's also debate about whether the distinction between surface structure and deep structure is even valid.
Hmm. Interesting.
Some argue that meaning is inseparable from the actual words and structure of the text, that you can't truly separate the two.
So maybe the iceberg analogy isn't perfect.
Right. You can't understand the iceberg without also examining the ice itself.
Exactly.
But even though structuralism may not be as dominant as it once was, it was incredibly influential.
How so?
Well, it paved the way for other critical approaches to textual analysis.
Like what?
Like the one we're about to dive into. Rhetorical criticism.
All right, let's move on to rhetorical criticism then.
Okay.
But before we jump in,
yeah,
can you give me a quick rundown of some of the key figures who championed structuralism?
Sure.
Particularly in biblical studies.
Yeah.
You mentioned that Daniel Patey was a big name, right?
He was. Daniel Patey really popularized structuralism amongst biblical scholars.
He did.
Yeah, especially in North America. He emphasized something called synchronic analysis.
Synchronic analysis.
Yeah, instead of getting bogged down in the historical context,
okay.
or trying to figure out what the author intended,
right.
he focused on the text itself as it exists in the present moment.
Interesting.
For Pat, the meaning was all in those deep structures we talked about.
So did Pat care about the historical context at all?
Okay.
It seems like he was more interested in this internal structural world of the text itself.
He definitely prioritized the text's internal structure.
Okay.
He believed that by analyzing the relationships between different elements within the text,
mm-hmm.
you could unlock its deeper meaning.
Can you give me an example of how Pat actually applied this to biblical texts?
Sure.
It's one thing to talk about deep structures, but how do you actually see it in action?
He was particularly interested in how narratives work. For example, he analyzed the parable of the Good Samaritan using the ectantial model.
Wait, so even a simple story like the Good Samaritan has these hidden layers of meaning?
Well, on the surface, yes.
I always thought it was a straightforward story about helping those in need.
Well, Pat would argue there's more to it than that.
Okay.
He believed that by applying structuralist tools, we could uncover a deeper level of meaning embedded in the text's structure.
Interesting.
He even analyzed the story of Jesus and the Samaritan woman in John 4 using a similar approach.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm starting to see how this works.
Good.
But before we move on to rhetorical criticism, what about other examples of Pat's work?
Well,
I'm curious to hear more about how he applied structuralism to different biblical texts.
He also examined the interaction between Jesus and the Samaritan woman in John 4.
Okay.
He focused on the oppositions present in the text.
Like what?
Like Jesus versus the woman, spiritual water versus literal water, and knowledge versus ignorance.
Interesting.
He argued that these oppositions, the way they are resolved, reveal a deeper meaning about the nature of salvation and true knowledge.
Fascinating. So by analyzing these oppositions, he was able to uncover a deeper layer of meaning that might not be immediately obvious on the surface.
Exactly.
Okay.
He believed that these oppositions weren't accidental, but rather reflected a deliberate structuring of the text to convey a deeper message.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
All right, so we've explored the depths of structuralism and its quest for hidden meanings. Now, let's surface and navigate towards a different approach. Rhetorical criticism.
All right.
What's the deal with this one?
Well, have you ever read a book or listened to a speech that completely changed your mind about something or inspired you to take action?
Yeah, definitely. I remember reading this one book about the environment a few years back.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just the facts and figures, but the author's passion and storytelling that truly moved me to make changes in my own life.
That's a perfect example of the power of rhetoric.
Oh, wow.
Rhetorical criticism is all about understanding how texts are crafted to persuade, how they use language to create a desired effect on the audience.
So it's not just about what's being said, but like how it's being said.
Right.
The art of persuasion.
Exactly.
But how does this apply to biblical texts?
Well,
are we saying that the Bible is trying to persuade us of something?
Yes, but not necessarily in a manipulative way.
Okay.
Think of it more like effective communication.
Right.
The biblical authors were skilled communicators who used various techniques to engage their audience and convey their message in a compelling way.
Okay.
And this isn't a new idea. It goes all the way back to ancient Greece.
Wow.
And the works of classical rhetoricians like Aristotle.
So there's a history behind this.
Oh, yeah.
A whole system for understanding how persuasion works.
Exactly.
Tell me more about how scholars apply this to the Bible.
Well, when it comes to New Testament studies, there are two main approaches.
Okay.
One focuses on analyzing specific rhetorical techniques used in a particular passage.
Okay.
Things like metaphors, similes, and the way arguments are structured.
So, like, identifying a really powerful metaphor.
Yeah.
And figuring out why the author chose to use it.
Exactly. The other approach looks at the bigger picture.
Okay.
Analyzing entire texts in light of ancient rhetorical speech structures.
Rhetorical speech structures.
Yeah. These structures provided a framework for effective communication. Kind of like a blueprint for persuasive speaking.
Wait, so there was like a formula for persuasive speeches back then?
Yeah, think of it as a structure with different parts.
Okay.
Each serving a specific purpose.
Okay, give me an example.
Okay, so you often start with an exordium.
Exordium.
Yeah, which is like an introduction designed to grab the audience's attention. And there's the narratio.
Narratio.
Where you provide background information.
Okay.
And the prepositio.
Prepositio.
Where you clearly state your main point or argument.
So it's about setting the stage.
Yeah.
Laying out the context and then presenting your argument.
Exactly.
Makes sense.
Then you have the probatio.
Probatio. Where you present evidence and arguments to support your main point.
So that's where you like really build your case.
Right. And you might also have a refutatio.
Refutatio.
Where you address potential counterarguments, anticipating and dismantling opposing viewpoints.
So you're not just presenting your side.
Yeah.
You're also acknowledging and addressing the other side of the argument.
Exactly. It's about being comprehensive and persuasive.
Okay.
And finally, you wrap it up with the peroratio.
Peroratio.
Which is like a conclusion that summarizes your points and aims to leave a lasting impression on the audience.
Wow, that's a lot to keep track of.
I know, right?
Did ancient speakers really follow these structures so rigidly?
There was definitely room for flexibility.
Okay.
But these structures provided a solid foundation for effective communication.
Right.
And you can see echoes of these patterns in many biblical texts.
Really?
Yeah, especially in the letters of Paul.
So by understanding these ancient speech structures,
we can gain a deeper understanding of how Paul was communicating with his audience.
Precisely.
It's like having a key to unlock the persuasive strategies he was using.
Exactly. Now, it's important to remember that not all speeches were created equal. Wow. They had different goals and purposes.
Okay.
Classical rhetoric recognized three main types.
Okay.
Judicial, deliberative, and epideictic.
Okay, break those down for me.
Sure.
What are the differences between those three types?
Well, imagine you're in a courtroom.
Okay.
Judicial rhetoric is all about arguing the rightness or wrongness of a past action, trying to persuade the judge or jury to reach a specific verdict.
So judicial rhetoric is focused on the past?
Yeah.
On making judgments about what has already happened?
Exactly.
Okay.
Now contrast that with deliberative rhetoric,
right,
which is focused on the future.
Right.
It's about persuading or dissuading an audience about a future course of action.
Okay.
Like a politician trying to convince people to vote for a particular policy.
So judicial is about looking back and judging.
Yeah.
While deliberative is about looking forward and influencing decisions.
Precisely.
What about the third type?
Epideictic.
Epideictic rhetoric is a bit different.
Okay.
It's focused on the present.
Okay.
On praising or blaming something or someone to reinforce values and beliefs.
Hmm.
Think of it like a eulogy or a celebratory speech that aims to unite the audience around a shared set of values.
Okay, that makes sense.
So how did scholars start applying these ideas to the New Testament?
Yeah, it seems like a pretty big leap from ancient Greece to the Bible.
One of the pioneers was Hans-Dieter Betz.
Hans-Dieter Betz.
Yeah, he argued that Paul's letter to the Galatians was best understood as a judicial speech.
So Betz thought that Paul was structuring his letter like a lawyer presenting a case in court.
Exactly.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
What was Paul trying to prove in Galatians?
Well, Betz believed Paul was trying to defend the legitimacy of his gospel message.
And demonstrate that the teachings of the Judaizers who were trying to impose Jewish law on Gentile Christians were wrong.
So he was arguing for his interpretation of the gospel.
Yeah, he saw Galatians as Paul's attempt to convince his audience that his interpretation of the gospel was the correct one.
So Betz took those six parts of a rhetorical speech structure we talked about.
Right.
And mapped them onto Galatians.
He did. He identified the opening section of Galatians 1.6.11 as the exordium.
The exordium, okay.
The part where Paul grabs the attention of his readers and expresses his astonishment at their quick abandonment of his teachings.
So he's setting the stage.
Yeah.
And kind of grabbing their attention right away.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He saw the following section, 1.112, 2.14, as the narratio, where Paul provides background information about his own conversion and his authority as an apostle.
So he's establishing his credibility.
Right.
Okay.
He then identified the next section as the propositio,
mm-hmm.
where Paul clearly states his main point,
which is
that salvation comes through faith in Jesus Christ,
okay,
not through adherence to the Jewish law.
Gotcha.
And Betz went on to map out the rest of Galatians, identifying sections that functioned as the probatio, refutatio, and peroratio.
Wow.
Arguing that the entire letter follows this classical rhetorical structure.
But hold on.
Yeah.
If Paul was writing a letter, shouldn't it be more like deliberative rhetoric, trying to influence the Galatians' future actions and beliefs?
That's a good point.
It's not like he's in a courtroom trying to win a case, right?
You've hit upon a point of debate among scholars.
Oh, really?
Some, like Ben Witherington.
Ben Witherington.
Yeah, argue that Galatians is better understood as deliberative rhetoric.
Okay.
They see Paul as trying to persuade the Galatians to reject the teachings of the Judaizers and remain faithful to the gospel he preached.
So there's room for different interpretations.
Yeah.
Different ways of understanding the rhetorical purpose of Galatians.
Absolutely. It's not always a clear-cut case. The beauty of rhetorical criticism is that it encourages us to look at familiar texts with fresh eyes and consider different perspectives on how they functioned as persuasive communication.
Okay.
It reminds us that these texts were written for a specific audience in a specific context.
Right.
And understanding those factors is crucial to unlocking their meaning.
And Witherington
is
a well-known New Testament scholar, right?
Oh, yeah. Incredibly prolific.
I think I've seen his name on some commentaries.
He's written commentaries on many New Testament books.
Oh, wow.
And he often uses this rhetorical lens in his analysis.
Does he?
In fact, many of his commentaries are called social rhetorical commentaries.
Social rhetorical commentary.
Yeah, reflecting his focus on how these texts functioned as persuasive communication within their social context.
So he's really embracing this idea of understanding the Bible as a form of persuasive communication.
He is.
What other New Testament books has he applied this approach to?
Oh, tons. He's written commentaries on Romans, Philippians, Ephesians, Jude, and many others.
Wow.
All exploring how these texts use rhetorical techniques to persuade and influence their audience.
It sounds like rhetorical criticism has really gained traction in biblical studies.
It has.
But is it a perfect approach?
Well,
are there any limitations or potential pitfalls we should be aware of?
Of course. Like any approach, it has its strengths and weaknesses.
Sure.
It's not a magic bullet that unlocks all the secrets of the Bible.
Right.
We need to be careful not to force texts into a predetermined mold.
So what are some of those potential pitfalls?
Well,
what should we be cautious about when using this approach?
Well, one danger is the temptation to impose those ancient speech structures onto biblical texts too rigidly.
So you're saying it's tempting to, like, force it in there?
Yeah, it's tempting to say, aha, this section must be the probatio because it comes after the narratio.
Right, right.
But we need to remember that these structures were guidelines, not ironclad rules.
So we shouldn't force the text to fit the structure, but rather see if the structure helps illuminate the text.
Exactly. We always need to prioritize the text itself and be sensitive to its unique features.
Okay.
Another challenge is that those ancient structures don't always have clear markers within the text.
Mm.
It can be difficult to pinpoint exactly where one section ends and another begins.
It's not like Paul inserted chapter headings saying exordium or probatio.
Right. Yeah. And there's also debate about whether letters, which are a more personal form of communication, would have been structured in the same way as formal speeches delivered in public settings.
So are we maybe imposing a level of formality onto Paul's letters that wasn't actually there?
It's a valid question. Let's take Galatians 4.8.18 as an example.
Okay.
Some scholars see this section as part of Paul's probatio, where he's building his case against the Judaizers.
So he's using, like, logic and evidence to persuade his audience.
Yes. But what's interesting is that this passage also includes several phrases that are typical of letter writing, suggesting a shift in focus.
Interesting.
It feels more personal, more like Paul is making a heartfelt appeal to the Galatians rather than simply presenting a logical argument.
So by focusing too much on the rhetorical structure, we might miss the nuances of Paul's personal style and the emotional weight he's trying to convey.
Precisely. It's crucial to consider all the textual features, including those that are specific to letter writing, before jumping to conclusions about rhetorical structures.
Okay, so it seems like rhetorical criticism, when used carefully, can be a powerful tool for understanding how biblical texts work.
It can.
But it's not without its challenges, and we need to be aware of those potential pitfalls.
Absolutely. Rhetorical criticism can be incredibly insightful, especially when it comes to understanding the function of different sections within a text and the overall persuasive strategy of the author.
So it helps us see the text as a unified whole, rather than just a collection of isolated verses.
Exactly. It reminds us that texts like Galatians weren't just abstract theological treatises. They were persuasive documents written with a specific purpose and audience in mind.
Right.
Understanding those factors is crucial to unlocking their meaning.
So if we were to put on our rhetorical critic hats, what are some key takeaways for us as readers?
Well, first of all, try to identify the overall goal or purpose of the text.
Okay.
Is it trying to persuade you of something? To inspire you, to inform you.
Sure.
Once you have a sense of the overall goal, you can start to look for the specific techniques the author is using to achieve that goal.
So it's like being a detective, looking for clues to understand the author's strategy.
Exactly. Pay attention to the language, the imagery, the way arguments are structured. Look for metaphors, similes, and other rhetorical devices.
Right.
And think about how those elements contribute to the overall persuasive power of the text.
This has been incredibly enlightening.
I'm glad to hear it.
So as we wrap up our deep dive into structuralism and rhetorical criticism, what's the one thing you'd want our listeners to remember?
I think it's this. Approaching biblical texts, or any text for that matter, with a critical and analytical mindset can enrich our understanding and appreciation.
Mm-hmm.
Whether we're using structuralism to uncover hidden meanings or rhetorical criticism to understand persuasive strategies,
right.
These approaches remind us that texts are complex and multifaceted, and there's always more to discover.
That's a great takeaway. So for all you deep divers out there, here's a final thought-provoking question to ponder. Can you think of a recent speech, article, or book that you found particularly persuasive?
Ooh, good one.
What techniques might the author have used to achieve that effect? Until next time, happy diving.